I brought some handouts, illustrations, some examples of things for you. I'll pass them around. I think I can begin them in different places. Once we finish Hinduism, we'll go right into Buddhism. I have some pictures of Buddhists going on their retreat, some of monks, some pictures of them begging. Got different pictures of them that I took, some of them showing the lights that they have, 3,000 lights glistening, shows them worshiping at their temple, shows them meditating. So I think you'll really enjoy looking at these. There's also a book called Who Are They? Talks about the Palace of Gold, that one in West Virginia that's been closed down now. Here's this Swami Prabhupada, the one who brought Krishna consciousness to America and the world. And here's one on entitled The Lord Buddha. It's a picture book about Buddha, like a comic book that you might buy in the store, except this is to help teach kids about the Lord Buddha. And then here's one golden picture of the Buddha that I have, and I thought I had another card here. That they have one that shows Krishna. Krishna is supposed to be the whole God. Yes?
I thought for some reason Buddha wasn't worshipped. I thought it was supposed to act like Buddha.
You are supposed to act like Buddha.
So why are they saying Lord Buddha?
Well, they, because he is the great model for them. And some of them, actually, if you would have to be told they don't worship him. Because if you ever go to a Buddhist temple, you'll find them bowing down in front of him. You'll find them lighting candles to him. You'll find them offering offerings to him. So I'll send these around. Perhaps I should send them around from the front and the back, but I'll send them over here with John. You can look at them at your leisure. And I'll bring this one up to... Okay, good afternoon for those of you out in tape land or CD land, and we're ready to continue with the finishing up on Hinduism. We have three more What Am I's, which are basic doctrinal teachings or habits or traditions of that particular religion, which we enunciate and then which we either say we agree with or don't agree with, or we partially agree with, or we categorically deny, as we use the scripture to compare it with. Because in this class of comparative religion, we do not compare a religion to a religion, though that would be natural to do since we cover a lot of them. But our main goal is not to say which religion cannot do the other, but rather which religion really does match up with the word of truth, which is God's revealed word. Which one matches up to what God would have us be? So we're finishing up Hinduism. Number four, number one, we did reincarnation. Number two, the caste system. Number three, the Vedas are holy. But number four is no founder, no creed. And they had no original founder. The Aryans or the Indo-Europeans brought these beliefs to India. The Indians then accepted, which were forced on them, like how to worship gods. Then the Indians added in their own tradition to make it Indianism or Hinduism. So they took those basic teachings of how to worship the gods, incantations, spells, prayers, and so on, and traditions, and they added into it their own culture to make it Hinduism. So it has no founder, no creed. What do we say? Well, Matthew 16:18, true religion... Somebody's coming to you again out of Hinduism and saying, well, we don't have any founder or any creed. And you say, well, what do the scriptures say? Should you have a founder and should you have a creed? Matthew 16:18, we read this, and I say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Jesus Christ is the recognized founder of Christianity. God sent him into the world to build the church. He said, I will build my church. So we do have a founder, Jesus Christ. In the Old Testament, they were also the church in the wilderness. So they're a carry-on of what was physical Israel to now spiritual Israel. And Jesus Christ, in the form of the God of the Old Testament, was the one who dealt with them as well. So true religion does have a founder, Jesus Christ. Matthew 4:4, we would say, would be our creed. creed we might live by. Matthew 4 and verse 4. It's sort of all-encompassing. Some say, what is your creed? You show them the Bible. Here's my creed. We don't have some little credo statement. Here it is. It's the Bible. So Matthew 4, 4, Jesus Christ said, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. We believe in following what God teaches for us today. That would be our creed. In Ephesians 2:20, I mentioned this last time. I'm rehearsing with you because I recall these now. Ephesians 2:20 talks about, we're founded on the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ being the chief cornerstone. So he's the founder, but we could also add the apostles and the prophets also add to our foundation. Okay, number five, holy objects, honoring the sacred. Pro, and I covered this quickly with you, there, Psalms 99, verse 9, holy hill. Isaiah 64, 10 talks about holy cities. 1 Corinthians 7, 14 talks about your children are holy. And 1 Thessalonians 5, 27 talks about holy brethren. Okay, so we do know that it is not wrong to have holy objects, but who designates them holy? God does. God says, this is holy, that's holy. He makes things holy because he is holy. The contrary to this is Exodus 23, where he says, do not worship idols, and Romans 1, verse 23. And I don't have a number. Oh, yes, I do have number 6. Karma, the law of deeds, from good comes good, from evil, evil. Galatians 6, 9 talks about reaping what we sow. 2 Corinthians 9, 7, I did cover this. James 2, 13, mercy. He talks about that we need to have mercy in the mix. Don't just say, I'm going to exact whatever good, you're going to get good. Whatever evil, you're going to get evil. You're always going to get repaid with evil. You're always going to get evil back. No, because God does show mercy when a person repents. Okay, then we said essay questions comparing Calkin to Christ, or what form of worship. We talked about that. Bhakti, karma, or jnana. Which one might you choose? How many, let's just take a show of hands, you could think on the spot. How many are more comfortable with worshipful devotion? Bhakti, the type. If you were to apply worshipful devotion toward our God and Jesus Christ, how many like that better? Okay, not too many. We don't have too many worshipful devotees. How many are more comfortable with deeds, action, doing? How many are more comfortable with doing knowledge? How many are not comfortable? You guys aren't comfortable. Now, if you were to apply this, because you do, you know, we go to services. Going to church services is what I call worship. You go to church services as community. On your own, you worship too, by how you feel and what you say and how you think toward God. But at church services, you stand up and you sing your hymns and you have special music that helps you worship God as you think of the beautiful words that are being sung and the music that moves you. Some people like that. It's not the only means of worship. Well, you send your tithes and offerings in. That's worshipful devotion. You give sacrifices by going to pick up people and help people. That's worshipful devotion. It could also be mixed in with deeds. Karma would be the deeds you do, following God's way of life, trying to live it, trying to do it. Are you action-oriented? That would be that area. And jnana would be knowledge. I like to really study my Bible. I really like acquiring knowledge. Okay, so those would be those three. That's what I would have you do. Hinduism is not an easy religion for the West, but lots of Westerners are being swallowed up by it as it is packaged in Western terminology, Western words, and exported. New Age has a lot to do with Hinduism. So a lot of those Krishna consciousness, Krishna worship is taking one part, one appearance of Vishnu and making that an object of worship. Hare Krishna. You know why they have their one lock of hair? So that when God's ready to take them up, he can just has a nice handle. Just take them up away from things. That's what I'm told. All right, we're going to move to Buddhism. Buddhism, about 380 million, roughly, in the world. Give or take. I haven't counted them lately. So give or take one or two. Let's go down and just use this. Okay, so we're going to study Buddhism. Buddhism is a religion also that came out of India, and here comes Kathy with her Buddhist handouts. And I thank Kathy. Kathy does a lot of running for all of us and for all of you, and I thank her for it. I appreciate it very much to help. It sure saves me a lot of time of doing a lot of clerical things to have her, as it does to many of us. Okay, so Buddhism is a religion that also has grown out of India. Here you see one of the images of the Buddha, and this shows the Buddha in a meditative pose. He was a model, and he's not viewed as a god. At least their teaching is he's not viewed as a god. I can't tell you what the minds of the people who go there. He was supposed to be a model for them, but you see these huge images, and there's not a lot of similarity in the images, and the images vary from country to country where it is. And we'll see there are a couple of types of Buddhism. There's not just one type, though I'm going to try to tell you about the more conservative type of Buddhism. Here you have a golden Buddha with the earth-touching pose. When you watch the statues, you want to see what their hands are doing, like hula dancers. You want to see what their hands are doing. You don't want to watch their hips. When the hula dancers, they tell you watch their hands. So in Buddha, you don't want to be taken away by his color. You want to watch his hands. Okay, his hand pointing to the earth is picturing, you know, the earth-touching pose, indicating that the strength comes from the earth. Buddhists kind of rule out the God and the heavenly, and it's kind of like reach in and do it yourself. You've got strength within you that you can draw from your own strength. You can reach down, you can deny yourself, and you can receive strength inside by meditation, by concentration, and we'll see that. Here you see possible teaching pose, this book titled What is Buddhism? But you see another view of the Buddha, with his hand up. It's a possible teaching pose. So he has various poses. Some of them he's reclining. Some of them he's sitting and cross-legged, touching the ground in a yoga pose. Here's another one. Look at the artwork of the Buddha. But notice around his head this halo that he's been granted, picturing him as a saint, not necessarily object of worship. Okay, here's an introduction to Buddhism. Sorry about the underline on the I. I didn't even... If you were to follow Buddhism, you would believe in salvation through your own efforts. Salvation through your own efforts. Much similar to tribalism. Tribalism would be through your own efforts. The goal is nirvana. Nirvana. Nirvana is described as a blowing out and extinguishing. Like if you have a candle and you blow it out, that's nirvana. So you live all your whole life to have it blown out. But literally, they believe it's like almost a new birth, like a little child, like you become a babe again, like a new birth situation. But for them, humanly, it's the extinguishing of the self, a blowing out or extinguishing of the self when you're finally ready, and they would believe you join a world soul too. But they do not look to a Brahman as a great god or anything. Buddha is a model with different poses and images, but not to be worshipped as a god. Now, that's their teaching. And again, we said, cannot always vouch for what the people say. So if you were going to be talking about Buddhism, it would be wrong for you to say, oh, the Buddhists worship Buddha. That's not their teaching. Okay, and I've heard many people make that mistake. Well, Buddhists worship Buddha, and this one worships this one, and so on. No, they don't. They really don't believe in worshiping Buddha. At least that's not their teaching. Whether people do it or not is another matter. Catholics say their images are only to remind them of Mary, of the saints, and so on. And yet you find people kissing them and, you know, bowing down to them, having little shrines to them. The gods are largely ignored in Buddhism. So they don't pay much attention, even though Hindus had, what, 330 million of them, and you could pick whatever one you wanted or ones and have those as your... the ones you look to. Gods are largely ignored. Buddha taught a balanced way of life by comparison to the Hindus, though he still retained somewhat of the asceticism, because you'll see there's certain rules and regulations that he laid down for his monks, such as you cannot eat any solid food after noon. No solid food after noon. And the monks do not sleep on raised platforms. They generally sleep on the floor. When we were in California, we had the opportunity to take our students to Wat Thai. Wat Thai, which is the Thai temple in Los Angeles. And we had they received us very graciously. We would go there. They were so nice to us. And while you walk into the temple, you take your shoes off, you walk in, and we'd go over and sit down, and they would usually have a monk or someone, and sometimes the abbot there would come. And the abbot who was there, who was the man in charge of the Wat Thai temple in Los Angeles, is now the head of all the monks over in, he's the one who serves the queen and king in Thailand. Prateptsapan, he's the one who served over there. I don't know, Justin, your uncle, does he ever mention Prateptsapan? Prateptsapan, his uncle Leon Sexton is the one who has worked over there with the Thai peoples. But Prateptsapan used to be the man in Los Angeles, the abbot there. He was real friendly and kind. Students would come. We'd take our shoes off. They would tell us about Buddhism. They had a chance to see it, and they'd see people coming in. There's a big altar there, and people coming in, and there's a golden Buddha. People would come in and put gold leaf on him to support the talk. Bring in chickens, and, well, I don't think they were live chickens, but anyway, they'd bring in whatever, food, eggs and different foodstuffs and so on, bread or whatever, and just leave it there because that they were giving it to the monks. And in fact, when our students left, they had so many eggs, they gave them to the students. Now, they were raw. The students could take them back to their dorms, I guess, and cook them. They would give them you know, dozens of eggs to go back. Sometimes they would have a little show that they would put on from some of the young people in their group, in their congregation, or who attended there. They had like a little show for us to see. Other cases, they would just tell us and show us some things. And they would answer questions for us because they could speak English too. You had other monks. The one thing we always told the girls, do not touch the monk. You touch a monk, you could cause him to have great trouble, great sin, because especially the girls touching them, because they don't want to have any sensual desires or anything else. So we said, don't rush up to him. Hi, Mr. Monk. Oh, no, you could cause this guy lots of problems to have to repent of afterwards. So we said, don't give him any problems when you go there. They originated in India, but they have thrived outside of that country. India, in the main, has put down Buddhism. Put down Buddhism. So they have thrived in Sri Lanka, and they also thrive in Thailand. And that would be the religion of the elders, which is called Theravada. I'll give you the explanation of the two in a moment. There are two branches. One is Theravada, and one is Mahayana. The Mahayana and one is called Hinayana, which is a small vessel, and the other is called Mahayana, a large vessel. The small vessel is the religion of the elders, Theravada. They're the ones that kind of hold the closest to the original teachings of Buddha. Where the Mahayana, the larger raft, it says, this is like a big ship. We can get lots of people on this ship if we just follow the people's culture. So they accepted all types of things. They made it broad. They made the teachings broad and interpreted. And they also added into them some of the mysterious or mystical ways into that Mahayana religion. So you may find Mahayana Buddhism in Tibet. You may find Mahayana Buddhism in Korea. You may find Mahayana Buddhism in Japan, in some of those areas which have a much larger population than Thailand or Sri Lanka, who tend to be the more conservative Buddhists. Okay. I think it's important to understand Buddha, the person. I have a book called Founders of Great Religions. And I hadn't quoted this one recently, but I've read it before. But I hadn't quoted it recently. It talks about Buddhism, and again, right, born in 560 B.C., or Buddha, he was 40 years younger than Mahavira, which was another sage, and the span of his life coincided almost exactly with that of Confucius. Now, you'll find Confucius and Buddha, you will like. I think. I like them. I like them for what they stood for. I don't like them because they started a false religion. I don't like them because they brought people false. But a lot of the things that they brought were very good. Okay, very good.
You know, on the slide that showed the golden Buddha.
Yeah.
There was a
that wheel.
Yeah, and it had a picture of a pyramid. With
yeah.
The top missing, just like on our dollar bill.
Yeah. The significance of that, I don't recall, but it has to somehow do with also the kind of the mystery of the religion too. Some of the mysteries did have the pyramid in there. You'll see a wheel of understanding as well, which they all have and teach. But let me share with you just a few things. It says, okay, many of these lands hold that he was not only a god, but he was not a god, but only a great teacher. Sometimes it is gravely stated he was not over 16 feet tall. Images of him are often of that height. So he wasn't 16 feet tall, but they have a lot of them. But I thought this was interesting. Different as were their environments and profound as were some of the differences in their teachings, none of the founders of the other religions was so much like Jesus as was the light of Asia. So they called Buddha the light. Now we'll see that Buddha, when he was born a rather rich prince into a rather rich family that had kind of an enclosed area in which they lived. And what Buddha did, he was brought up in all the arts. He learned all these things. He was taught by the gurus of Hinduism. And he was shielded from the world. So he never saw sickness. He never saw poverty. He never saw death. And on one trip outside his surroundings, his castle grounds or whatever you want to call it, his father's plantation, on one trip outside, he saw all of those on one trip. He saw people sick and shriveled up. He saw them carrying a cadaver. He saw the sickness and the disease, and then he also saw this serene monk. Sickness and death and this serene monk. And he wondered, which is the way to go? I'll share that with you in a moment. And you'll find that Buddha then decided to leave home. He went back home and he meditated, what's the meaning of life? And so he went out to find the meaning of life. He saw a monk along the way too. Which way is the way to go? So he went out, decided he would try to find God and meaning. He kissed his wife goodbye and his son, and he went out with his driver or his guard. And when he got out there, he changed clothes, gave him his princely garments, and he renounced all that he was. He went out to try to find the meaning of life. And he wandered about, learning from this person and that person. He finally joined a band of ascetics, people who deny themselves. And during his time when he was, I think I mentioned right at the beginning of the semester, during this time he was wandering about, he ate so little, one bean a day. Can you imagine sitting down, your only meal? Here's this bean, whether it's a kidney bean, a lima bean, a string bean, one. Enjoy. Cut it up in three parts and you can have it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. He became so skinny, and I have a picture of him. I think I put that on there. I think I put it on for you. It's called the Black Buddha. It's a picture of the Buddha. I think it'll be on there. It's a portrait of him, or a statue of him, which actually shows his, you could see his rib cage. He is so thin. And you could see his stomach. And he said, he made this quote, at one time, when I thought I would touch my stomach, I actually touched my spine. He had become so weak. He would deny himself so much, it actually says that the dirt built up on his body so much that it just fell off of itself. He did all that because he was trying to find God. He almost died, fainted, and would have died if his disciples, his few friends who were more balanced, swooped him up, gave him some rice, like rice and water mixture to help him come back to health. And after he did that, he realized that this asceticism was not the way to go, complete asceticism. So he then began to teach a balanced way, and he broke with the ascetics, and we'll see the story as we go on. So he was brought up a prince in Nepal. He was sheltered from the real world. He was taught Hindu principles. One day outside his complex, he saw four sights that affected his life. He saw an old man. He saw old age. That was the other one, a person just wrinkling up. That's all you do is you live life to get old. He saw a person who was sick, who was infirm. Maybe his face was all eaten or whatever, leprosy or something. He saw a dead person being carried, lifeless body. And he saw a monk. And he thought, what's the meaning of life if all you do is get old? What's the meaning of life if all you do is get sick and die? What's the meaning of life? And he saw a monk who seemed to be, to him, serene and peaceful. So he wanted to go find out what was the meaning of life. Remember at the beginning of the year we said one of the things religion tries to do is answer for people, what is the meaning of life? Buddha tried to find it. He renounced it. He went. From that time forward, he pondered the meaning of life. What's going on with life? He left home to find meaning at around the age of 30. He tried asceticism. He ate one day, I mentioned that, one bean a day, so he could touch his spine from his stomach. That's the picture that I showed you from that book. You see how thin? That's apparently a portrait that was taken of him showing him after his fasts. It shows a black statue with his rib cage showing and his stomach so little that you could just literally touch your spine from that. He fainted. He was revived by his disciples. He fasted. Now, this is another part that's similar. He fasted and meditated under the Bo tree. Some say it was a fig tree. For 49 days. Now, Jesus fasted for a long 40 days. While he was fasting, he was tempted by the devil. The devil tried to pull him away, tried to get him out of this meaning, trying to search for meaning in life. And he determined he would not come out of this until he understood the meaning of life. Okay, so he determined, this was after he gained his strength back, after he almost died of fasting. He determined he would not come out until he could find the meaning of life. And after that, he arrived at what he called a middle path, a more balanced approach to life, a middle path that contained four noble truths. Interesting, what did Buddha bring? Truth. What did Jesus Christ come into the world to bring? Truth. Is this Satan's deception to have somebody like this ahead of the time Jesus came into the world? About 600 BC, this is, or 6th century BC. Or is this God giving a foretaste, allowing people to come to some of the same understanding that God would bring through Jesus Christ to set up the world to maybe accept the Lord and Savior? Probably the deception. But you see how close he is. Watch. Four noble truths he brings. And what else does he bring? He brings an eightfold path. And what is a path? It's a way. What God teaches us, what is it called? A way of life. So there are a lot of similarities. After he had understood there's a balanced way, a middle path, he said, I am awake. When he came out of this, after he had resisted the devil, after he had figured out what he felt was the way to go for salvation, he said, I am awake. I am the Buddha. The name meaning the enlightened one, the one who is awakened. Now, I want to show you what Buddha disliked about Hinduism, because Buddha broke with Hinduism. So let's take a look and see what he disliked about Buddhism. He disliked the authority. He did not like the grip that the Brahmins, the priestly class, had on the people. He did not like it that they were the top dogs and nobody else had a chance. unless they went through multiple lifetimes to do so, to finally get into that caste. He did not like their authority. Secondly, he did not like their rituals. Buddha ridiculed the Hindu prayers and ceremonies to the gods. He said that's hogwash. He ridiculed them. So you might say, when Jesus Christ walked the earth, he also said, in vain do you worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of man. Buddha said, this is hogwash. Speculation. He did not like to speculate about the soul, the universe, or the infinite. So when somebody came to him, I remember one person my freshman year said, now what if Adam hadn't sinned? I said, but the point is, he did. What if questions in that line can lead you nowhere? You could say, what if he hadn't sinned? Well, he would have died because he was still flesh and blood. He would have had to be changed. Flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. So if he had been made and he stayed perfect, sinless, he still would have had to be changed in a moment. Because you can't live in God's kingdom in the flesh. So either way. But the what if questions, what if Satan hadn't sinned? What if this? You can get into a lot of what if things, but what if doesn't matter because it didn't happen that way. And so Buddha tried to stay away from the speculation. Well, this might be this, that might be that. He did not like to speculate about those things in the spirit realm that he felt you could not understand. Number four, he broke with tradition. He believed Hindus were buried in the past. They wanted to use a certain language to transmit their teachings. And he believed in reaching the people in their own language, talking in a way that they could understand. So tradition, he broke with tradition. He also broke with the term grace. He said this, don't pray for me, for when I'm gone, I'll really be gone. He believed that reincarnation took way too long. And he thought that Buddhas, people who were enlightened, could point the way to salvation. He didn't like the idea of grace of one life after another life after another life. And he said, don't pray for me, for when I'm gone, I'll really be gone. So he believed when you're dead, you're dead. And don't try to pray for my soul afterwards, because whatever I do now is what I'm going to receive at that time, because he also believed in the law of karma. And number six, the supernatural. He condemned divination and soothsaying. He condemned divination and soothsaying, and he said, if a person tries to work a miracle, he is not my disciple. So if somebody comes to you and tries to sell you some miracle-producing stuff, somebody comes to you and tries to sell you some elixir that's going to cure everything from arthritis to gout, don't accept him. He's not my disciple. If he comes to you to have some healing campaign, don't accept him. He's not my disciple. So Buddha tried to stay away from what he called the supernatural. Now here is Four Noble Truths. After his fasting under the Bo tree for so long, here's what he came up with. One, suffering comes through bodily senses. The reason people have suffering is because their body, their desires, are initiating it. And he said, suffering comes from desire. Okay, you have the bodily senses which stimulate desire. Your hormones that are coursing through your system are causing you to have desires, wrong desires. Suffering comes from desire. You desire to have something, you do it, and then you get in trouble. Three, desire can end. You don't have to be subject to desire, is what he was saying. Desire can end. That's the third noble truth. And the fourth noble truth is this can be accomplished by the Eightfold Path, or the middle way of avoiding extremes. Now, why do you think he was for the middle way? Because he almost died, in my opinion. He almost died in asceticism. He realized that when you were so strict. Now, what does the Bible say about a middle way? Is there a middle way? Is God's way extreme? Here's what I find. In Ecclesiastes, it says, do not be righteous over much. When a person is over much righteous, what does he or she become? Self-righteous. If you are righteous over much. Now, on the other hand, you don't want to become too lackadaisical. No zeal at all. So we have to be zealous for God's way. But we have to live it in a balanced way. God's way is a balanced way. It's not unbalanced. You don't study the Bible 30 hours a day. I know there are only 24 hours, so it would be impossible to do. But you don't study so much that you don't pay attention to anybody else. You don't do anything. You don't isolate yourself and say, I'm going to pray for 6 hours, study for 6 hours, and I'm not going to see anybody. I'm not going to spend time with people because people corrupt me. You don't pull yourself apart. So you are balanced in your application to life. God wants us to be balanced human beings, not weird, not one side or the other. Remember, what is sin? You know what sin is? Hamartia. It means to miss the mark. So if you miss the mark, and here you have a target. And I stand back with my bow and arrow, and I shoot my arrow, and I get it right in the middle. There I go. What am I? I'm balanced. But I go, I shoot on the left. I missed to the left. I'm liberal. I shoot to the right. I still missed. I still missed. If you miss to the left, if you miss to the right, you have sinned. The people who miss to the right might say, oh, God's law. They're breaking God's law. You're a lawbreaker. I know that God's law says you're a lawbreaker. You're a lawbreaker. What are they doing? Judging others with the law of God. They missed to the right. The other person says, doesn't really matter. Doesn't really matter if you keep God's law. You know, God understands if you have to break it once in a while. God understands the little white lie. God understands. You missed it to the left. You have to be hitting it right in the middle. Some people say if you miss it to the left, you're a sinner. To the right, you're even more righteous than here. I say that's baloney. Okay. God wants us to be balanced in life. Here's his eightfold path. Here's the path he felt if you walked in this path, if you went down this path, this road, that you would have opportunity to overcome your desires. Now, by the way, Buddhists have something like 227 rules that they must follow. And by the way, here's that picture I was going to send around, picture of Krishna. And this is interesting, which we just studied last period. It says, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Supreme Personality of Godhead. It says on the bottom, pictured here is Krishna, meaning the all-attractive one. Now, here's what it says about, and this comes from that palace of gold, the one in West Virginia, Krishna consciousness. Listen what they claim for Krishna. The Supreme Lord and his many names, such as Allah, Jehovah, Buddha, and Yahweh. The different names are given according to his various attributes. But he really is Krishna. You see what they tried to do? Oh, it's okay. You can worship Krishna because he's really Yahweh. He's really Jehovah. He's really... How devastating, how damnable that they do that. But you can take a look at the picture. It's absolutely mind-boggling. Remember what they taught about Buddha? Hindus say Buddha was one of the appearances of Vishnu. He came to the earth to deceive the Hindus, to see if the Hindus would remain faithful to their teachings. Pretty good way, pretty good spin to put on him. Buddha in no way did that. Buddha came to the earth to correct their teachings, not to deceive them. So here's his Eightfold Path. Number one is right beliefs or right understanding. So a person who is going to be to walk down this path, he has right beliefs or right understanding. I have further explanation of these, so I'll see if I can pull it out here real quickly for you. That's pretty. Here we go. Right understanding of life, the meaning of life, the nature of existence, the moral law, factors regarding life, birth and death, and continuing bonds that you have in life. So right beliefs. So again, would we agree that you should have right beliefs? Absolutely. Orthodoxy means right belief. Second, right resolve or right thought. So here, this thought is supposed to be pure, free from ill will, cruelty, sensual desire, any obstructions to your mental faculties. So again, right resolve, right thought. You don't let your mind be pulled away. You don't lose concentration. Thirdly, right speech. No lying, no backbiting, no gossip, no laud. You're not supposed to laud. Not being loud, rather, or excitable, and you're supposed to speak with kindness and wisdom. If you ever notice a monk, a Buddhist monk, they're very serene. Sometimes they'll smile, and usually the monks are very serene and very peaceful, very gentle. Now, Pratepsipon, he would touch the girls. Some of our students used to teach him, April Waybright used to teach him English. Because when he came to America and they established a Thai temple in Los Angeles, he couldn't speak English very well. So he wanted them. He was a friend. Dr. Hay had known them. Visited. We used to have projects in Thailand. Mr. Armstrong traveled to Thailand. So they got to know him, know of the Buddhist faith quite a bit. And so we would send students over there to help. It was kind of like a religious project or whatever. And this one girl would actually teach him English. And he would touch her any time. I guess he was above being tempted anymore. But he would touch her on the arm or slap her on the shoulder or whatever when she would teach him something that he thought was rather laudable. Okay, and he could have fun. He would tend to be more happy and go lucky and smile and laughter. The other guys were a little more serious. I guess they were juniors. They hadn't learned how to control their emotions yet. So that's right speech. Right action. Right action has to do with five precepts. Five precepts. Don't kill. Don't steal. Don't misuse the senses. Don't lie. You're supposed to be sincere and honest. And don't use alcohol or drugs so that you can remain clear-minded. So those had to do with right action. Then he has right vocation. You should not be involved with any occupation that involves harm to others. Isn't that interesting? If you're dealing with weapons, slave trade, alcohol, poison, dealing with flesh, in a sense of a hunter or a fisherman, you don't want to have anything to do with those because you're dealing with flesh and you want to away from that. Right effort. This has to do with just striving for good. Right effort has to do with avoiding negative or unhealthy qualities, developing positive ones, inducing healthy, positive thoughts, rejecting unhealthy ones, and enhancing the good one has had already. So right effort. Number seven is right contemplation. Some say right-mindedness. This is an awareness of the body, feelings, mind, and ideas. Kind of a sixth sense, going beyond the intellectual mind. And you know what they do to practice that? I've seen them doing it. They will stand and they will practice walking. And they walk and meditate. And I mean, they are so good at it. I'm wobbly. But they are so good at it. They pick one foot up and they put it down. And then they pick the other up and put it down. And they pick the other up, and they're meditating all the way. And if you see some of their pictures, they have like a sand, it's like a path. And at one end, I think, is a skeleton, and at the other end, I think, is a beautiful flower or something. So they walk toward one as they're contemplating death or whatever, and they walk back the other way. And they try to just keep their minds. Now, I don't believe this is right. Okay, I don't think you empty your mind in order to absorb other things. I think you clean your mind of dirt, but you don't empty your mind of good. For them, you want to empty your mind so you can just meditate on this one thing. I don't believe you should do that. But that right contemplation, trying to put yourself in a sense of drawing from within all the wisdom and strength that you can muster. And then finally, right meditation or right concentration. And this one is meditation on one topic, in which they would avoid sensuality, ill will, lethargy, worry, skepticism. It takes long training, but ultimately opens up the way to nirvana, practicing these eight. So this is what he taught. He said there's a middle way, that you have problems because you have your bodily desires. You have problems because you yield to those bodily desires. Those, you can stop that, and you can stop it by practicing this eightfold path. This eightfold path will help you come out of that. First two, concentrate on wisdom. The second three, concentrate on virtue. And the last three, apply to concentration. Now, they believe there are three jewels, three things that are very important to the Buddhist faith. One, the Buddha, as an example to look to. So they say we look to these three jewels of our faith, three gems. Two, the Dharma, the teachings, what he's taught to live by. And three, the Sangha, or the monks, to help guide them. Now, if some of you have seen the monks that I showed you, in Theravada religion, Theravada Buddhism, every male should find some time in life, maybe even once a year, but certainly in one time in life, that he goes for a month to a retreat and becomes like a monk. And so he lives like a monk for 1 month. It's not queen for a day, but monk for a month. Okay, boo. All right, but anyway, you go and you become a monk for 1 month. You practice that. You practice their faith that way. And it's to kind of get you spiritual, like a spiritual retreat. It is the religion of the elders. So you go to become like the elders, who would be the monks in this case. So that's why they talk about the three jewels, being like a monk. There are two major branches, and I'll stop with this. Two major branches. One claims to be based on the original teachings. The other has made additions to the basic teachings of Buddha. And they are Theravada or Hinayana Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism. Theravada is the one that's more conservative. Mahayana means the larger raft. You have a big ship in which people can enter, where Hinayana is a little small yacht. Not as many people can get on board. Not as many people come to Hinayana because it's a little more strict, a little more down the line of the teachings of Buddha. I'll stop here. And we'll pick it up next time on Tuesday. We'll finish up Buddhism and give you a chance to do the What Am I's. So have a great rest of the day, and I'll see you tomorrow morning.